This is Ben Crenshaw. You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Hi there, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, amigos, compadres, friends, enemies, and antagonists. Welcome. We love you all, one and all. It's time for a Saturday edition of Radio Golf Show. And as John Elton said many moons ago, Saturday night's all right for fighting. On the program tonight, none other than multiple Golf Show All-Star and three-time PGA of Germany Teacher of the Year, four-time.
Yeah, I won a junior trainer of the year, too.
I apologize. Four-time.
I was very proud of that, by the way.
Yeah, you should be. But I think the coolest was when you won Teacher of the Year and Hurley won Player of the Year.
Yes, that must have been super. Done before.
Yeah. And as always, there's only one way to introduce him. I'm on the top of the world looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love has put me at the top of the world. Ted, mein Lieber, how are you? And many thanks for making a pit stop once again at Casa Golf Show.
Well, how I am, I'll tell you how I am. Some people measure their days and how many nice things that were told by them, or maybe how they played in golf. I measure my days by how many energy drinks I take, need to get through the day. So this is 4 half liters going right now. So to me, any reason to drink an energy drink's a good day. So 4 half liters, I'm quite happy. And I've got another one in there in case this goes on a little longer.
There we go. And it just might. Q School, from where you just came back, and college golf, a field that you know more about than anybody else in Germany, will be our light planken. Why college golf? At the beginning of the year, I canceled my subscription to Golf Punk magazine simply because I found it too much like the other middle of the road publications, and the only edge they really had left was the name. And especially the cover stories made me shake my head more often than not, like when the great Martino Borgmeier was the reigning long drive champion of the world, they put Kyle Berkshire on the cover, or the time they put Adrian Meronk on the cover. Why? Well, that's neither here or there. So the second to last cover story about Eduardo Molinari was brilliant. However, when my last issue arrived a couple of weeks ago and I saw Rick Shields on the cover, I almost got physically ill, burned all my Scott and Lyle stuff, Lyle and Scott stuff. Was happy that my cancellation was the right decision. But then out of the corner of my eye, at the bottom left of the cover, I saw the words college golf. And why more of Germany's young stars decide to study in the U.S. Immediately I thought, oh my God, long ball in Golf Punk, fuck yes. The story written by editor-in-chief Rüdiger Meyer does not even mention you. Did they contact you for this article?
I don't know who the guy is. I have no clue. I don't really care, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Crazy as this sounds, right? I mean, every time I go out and I work with a junior team, a men's team, or whatever, I really realize that's what tanks me. You know, that's the thing I love doing the best, right?
Right.
Business stuff. And I don't have a website or anything because I'm like, I don't want to have 40 customers and spend my whole day and night doing this, right? If you're working on 5 to 8 kids at a time, you can still have a life. But, you know, to do this properly, I mean, you got to be from morning to night. Like, I'm talking to guys in California, that's 9 hours from now. So you might be up till 3 in the morning talking to some coach if that's the only time he has. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty, engrosses you. And it's just, if you're going to do some, you know, I always say there's two things I can't do. One, I can't do anything half-ass, and I hate working with people that do things half-ass.
Right.
So I feel a lot of, I started doing this 20-something years ago when I saw people were paying these companies to do horrendous jobs, right? And what really pissed me off was when I found out about five or six of the kids that I did for free actually were paying these companies. So I said, wait, I might as well try to make some money out of this. And it's pretty taken off pretty well. I've done really well with it. I mean, I'm lucky that a lot of my students are great golfers. So then obviously through that, all you need is one or two top golfers that a lot of coaches want, and you'd be surprised how many friends you can make. It just kind of goes from there. And then when Hurley was in college, I always went to some of his college golf tournaments where I met all the coaches. And I found out from them, you know, I don't want to say they're desperate, but to have somebody who's an actual golf coach who can recognize talent and discern between what does this person have, at what level should they be playing, and what do they need to do to get better? Did they actually get some good information on these players other than the standard email with the same thing and they change the name, dear coach so and so, right?
Well, I mean, let's make one thing clear about and I want this to be a conversation for people who are thinking about sending their kids to the US from not only Germany but from Europe or even from in the States. And for young people who are thinking about going to college there. College is a non-revenue generating sport in the US, you know, unlike NCAA football or basketball.
Right. Here's how it works. Depending on which division you're in, one, two, three of the NCAA, you have to have so many sports teams, women and men together, to be in that division. You also have to give out the same amount of scholarships to women as you do to men. So if you've got a big college golf team or the football team that's given out 55 scholarships, they're doing horseback riding, underwater swimming for women, and whatever the heck it is, okay, to get it up to 50-50. Division two, they have a little bit less scholarships available, and they also have a smaller number of teams. Division three doesn't have any scholarships at all, but they're usually very good small schools, and what they try to do is they try to help the people out through academics. If you have a good grades, like in Germany, if you had an 1,4, 1.4, something like that, that would be a way, and a good SAT score, you might get as much as $20,000, $30,000 at a private university every year for your academics. And then if you really need more money, they have it based on need. You can fill out some forms and then they can give you some more money. That's how Division III works. And two, similar to that, if you look at like the Ivy League where Harvard is and all those schools, they don't give out any academic scholarships. I'm sorry, not academic. They don't give any, what do you call it?
Athletic.
Athletics. So I'm switching between English. Athletic scholarships. So everything's based on academics or basically need, right? But they're private universities. So private universities are a little bit better in that respect because they have their own rules. If you're a staatlich geförderte Uni, that means that your money is generated by state taxes, okay? University of Georgia. What happens is if your parents paid taxes in Georgia, you're going to pay one third the tuition of somebody outside. So a guy from Alabama is almost in the same league as a guy from Germany in that respect. Okay. Now, just so people know, you got room and board. That's your meals in your apartment. And that's usually about 25% of what your scholarship's going to cost. Then 70% is usually, regardless of, you know, how much the other one is your tuition and fees. Okay, so let's take if a uni if a university costs 35, it costs 50,000, you know, for an out-of-state guy or international, you're paying 35,000 in tax or in fees to go to school there. But if you're from Georgia, you're going to pay a third of that, so you might only pay 12,000, right? Now, for everybody, it doesn't matter where you're from, it costs just as much to eat and live there. So if it's 13 to 15,000 a year, that's what you pay yearly. You can choose the food program you're on and save a little bit of money. And then you got books and fees. And these fees start with how much it costs to get an ID card, all the way up to $2,500 sometimes if you have to have health insurance. So those are all the different fees that all universities go through. So how the scholarship or how the cost of the university is set up, it varies between private and state schools. The state private schools are generally more expensive, but they have the option of saying, okay, if you got a, let's say in German, a 2.1, right, which is a B plus average in the States, you could get up to maybe 15,000 if you had like a 1.4 or a 3.5 or something like that. They might give you 25,000. At a school like TCU that costs 75, 80,000 a year, which is an amazing amount of money, if you come in with like a 1.2 or 3.89 average, the university right out of the gate will give you 45,000 a year for academics. So now you're down to paying what you would for less than for a normal university
Right.
before you get a golf scholarship.
Yeah. So the academic requirements are definitely there, but
No, that's just to get in.
yeah, exactly. But how do the kids get a college golf scholarship? I mean, I imagine it's not just about shooting low scores, but it's also about shooting low scores in the right tournaments.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I run European golf rankings because the WAGR, which is a bit of a complicated thing to do properly, only basically does adults. Because what they do is they say, okay, if you win, let's say you play a global junior golf tournament and they run nice tournaments, okay? If you win, you'll get like 7, 7.5 points, okay? So what does that mean? That means you're in WAGR now, okay? You got to get in, you got to play your way in. But there's a thing called a divisor, which in German means Nenner. So they take all your total points for all your events and they divide them by eight until you've played eight events. So after four events, I'll give you an example. Eva Ringwald is a really smart girl. She'd won a bunch of tournaments, but she was sitting on like 2,600 WAGR, and her parents were all worried. Well, you know, how's she going to get such a bad WAGR? I said, what do you mean, bad WAGR? I said, divide her points by four, she'd be top 600 in the world. So four tournaments later, she was 820 or something like that. So coaches look at WAGR, but they also mostly look at my rankings because the way mine works, we start at 12 and up and we start ranking kids. And if you look at our rankings from 14 all the way up, all those top kids work their way all the way through. So coaches are really dialed in starting at 14. Now, why would they be dialed in? In the United States, you can commit to go to a university at 14 years old, okay? That's called a verbal commitment. That means, okay, I'm coming. So the coach writes you down, reserves the scholarship, whatever he offered you, right? When you get to be 17, then you can actually sign a contract with the school to officially go there. And as long as you do anything stupid or quit playing or whatever, they're going to give you that scholarship. So it's very important to college coaches, how are you playing? And sometimes, you know, they won't think about the kid till he's maybe 15 or 16. But like right now, next year, August 2025, probably 85% of the books are closed at Division I on scholarships. They're already working on 2026 and 2027. So what does that mean? They're already talking to 10th graders, okay? But if you look at our rankings, you'll see current. That means in the last 365 days. But you can move that dial to all. And like some of the German kids, we got their scores all the way back since they're 12 years old. Everything played in Germany and internationally. So that gives the coaches a good opportunity to see their scores. Now, here's how it works. If you try to do it yourself and send out a blanco letter to all these coaches with stuff, if you're lucky, they'll look at it, okay? But I mean, I get some of these letters to kids that send coaches. They're writing books, okay? And the coach is getting 60, some of these guys, 100 letters a week. He didn't have time to go through all that
Like
stuff.
a job application, almost.
Oh, yeah, almost it is. Yeah, exactly. And so he wants it fast. You know, show something. Show a picture of you with a pitcher in his hand. I'm this out. This my scoring average, blop, and whatever. Hopefully he writes back, right?
Right.
Get somebody like me that's going to help you. What I do is I sit down and I have a thing called a school finder where it's like 10 questions and I find out, you know, how important is weather? How important is school? What do you want to study? Okay. Is the schedule of the team important? How much important is your scholarship? And I've got some clients that the parents say, I don't care what it costs, I want my kid to go to one of these type of schools, right? Now, if they're a really good player, they can still get a good scholarship. But a lot of these good schools, you got to have the grades to be able to get in. Because what happens is admissions in top schools tells the college coach if that kid can be recruited.
Exactly.
So that's important to know. But basically what happens is the coaches nowadays with social media, they'll start following you. And the minute you know you're being followed by, let's make up some school, Auburn, right? You know Auburn's watching you. That's their way of saying, hey, we're watching you, right? And then you're going to follow them back. And at a certain period, I think it's in your junior year, which is 11th grade in Germany, they can actually reach out and start talking to you.
Right.
Okay. I think it
So,
might even change to 10th grade.
yeah. So, once a player has the attention of a coach, I would imagine in the States, then the coaches go out and watch these kids play. Do they come to Europe and watch the European kids play?
Will come to the German boys and girls, because that's a very good tournament. There's probably a top five junior tournament in Europe.
So the coach of Auburn will come to watch the tournament.
There's a guy he wants, heck yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And he'll follow that kid all 18 holes to watch him on the range, might say hello to his parents. I mean, you ain't going to talk to him much because at certain ages, you're not allowed to talk. But he's sitting there with a big Auburn hat on and an Auburn sweatshirt, or his assistant is, right? But you got to understand something, okay? So I'll tell you how I do things. And I hate doing this because I hate to give out my secrets, okay? I figure out what is the best fit for you. Now, trust me when I tell you this, 99 out of 100 people want to go to Stanford, okay? Great weather, great school, blah, 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 right? I'm saying, well,
Woods.
but you can only get so many people a year, maybe two or three max, and they can pick whoever they want, right?
But you're concerned also about the intangibles.
Oh, absolutely. I put in there, how important is it the feel for the team, the knowledge of the coach, the coaching style? I put all that stuff in there because I want to know what is it this person needs. And then what I usually do is I also talk to the coach of the team, not the team that he's trying to get on, but the team that the player plays on in Germany. Or I'll talk to the national coach of his country and say, tell me about this kid, right? Because the kid's going to tell you a story, but we all know if you got kids what those stories mean, okay? So I got to get down to the truth because I got two sides. You might be getting paid by the parents, but that college coach is your biggest customer. Colorado, I think I've put five or six kids in at Colorado. So as long as you keep producing for that coach, every time you call him, I guarantee you it ain't gonna be two rings and he's picking up. Okay.
And
So,
he must be looking at those intangibles as well.
that's what that's my advantage because I'm a golf coach. I know exactly what coaches are looking for,
Right.
right? And then after you talk to them, they look at the scores and they'll say, okay, that guy's looks pretty interesting. Can you show me a swing? So then you show him some swings, right? Then if he says, hey, when can we set up a talk? You say, okay, bam. Now we're knocking on the door, right? So what I usually do is, and I hope no coaches listen to this, I school the kids on how to do a proper interview. Even as far as what questions they should ask, right? I teach them, like you're looking at me and shaking your head. It's obviously you're interested in what I have to say. I teach them how in a Zoom call also to, not stand there and look over to the left and up here and check your phone. I mean, I'm not saying people do that, but you also be interested and ask good questions. And a lot of these kids, the coach will go, he's kind of on the fence as far as his results, but I'm really impressed with the way this kid carries himself. The one thing all good coaches know is if you get a kid, you're not getting him till he's 18 years old. So if you're starting to recruit him at 16, there's a lot of guesswork involved. Can he play? Absolutely. But in Europe, they can't really watch him play too much. So I'm their eyes, right? I'm the one that tells them what's the deal with these kids. And I might even get a coach and say, hey, can you give me a voice evaluation on this kid? And then I'll give a kid the parents a report on, or not the parents, sorry, the coach report on what this guy says. Because if I'm the guy they rely on to give a scholarship, I better be good at what I'm doing because I don't like to miss, right? Because I mean, and when you do miss, a kid can always transfer. But I've got parents over here, they're very interested in the well-being of their children,
As they should be, absolutely.
in the future of their children. And then I got a coach over here who's trying to do a job to be successful, right? And you got to meld those two together. And I'm pretty good at it, I would say, because I'm good at, talking to people and getting people to talk as you are. And it's not that hard to find the right mixture. But where you're really, really, really in trouble is, there might be a kid 50-50. And if you're trying to get a kid into a California school and this coach had been watching this kid play for a year and a half, it's almost like he's already a member of his team. So when he goes to choose, he's going to say, okay, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't, right? So you might miss out on that opportunity. So you have to know, I think probably the biggest mistake that most people do, well, there's two big mistakes most people do, is They assume because the coach has talked to you that he's going to give you an offer, you're going there. Okay. It's just a part of the process. It's getting you closer to the finish line. But the number one thing is at some point you got to have the conversation is, okay, what kind of offer, how interested you are you and me, right? And the guy might come right out of the gate and say, we got a lot of scholarship and we're looking for a good player. At that place, okay, you've got a chance of getting exactly what you're looking for. But I've had other coaches, and I'm not going to say any names, they'll lead you down the holy road and they'll make you have you pay your way all the way at school, give you a nice tour, and you think, God, this is the greatest place in the world. Oh, by the way, we only got 20%, so you got to pay $40,000 a year or something like that. And they think they're going to go out there and get an 80% scholarship. So to me, that's a complete waste of time. So that's a, something that has to be done, how do you want to say, in a very clean manner, that the coach and the kid talk about that. But you certainly don't want to talk about that at the beginning. I always tell people that the beauty of selling is finding out what it is this person wants and then saying, hey, this is what I got to sell. And the guy said, oh, I'm interested. Let's talk about how it would work. And then after the coach has decided, I'd really like this guy in my team. Now you're in a better position. Hey, coach, we haven't talked about this yet. What's your level of interest in me? Right. And then they might tell me, the kids or the parents say, they offered us 60%. I said, no, you're worth 70. You with me? And then the beauty of it is if you're really good at this job, you might have three or four schools that are after a kid. So he's got the leverage in those situations where if the coaches want them, they know they got to pump up the volume. That's kind of how that all works. But that's the work, obviously, between the kids and the school. We're not allowed to do any of that stuff, but we have the knowledge of knowing what somebody's worth. And that's the first step is, and I always tell the parents, I says, by the way, I'm talking long because I figure I'm answering about eight of the questions you were going to ask. That's the thing is really is to evaluate at the very beginning, where is this kid in his development and where does he fit in? All the parents, oh, I want him to go to the best school. I want him to play on the best team. Well, I got news for you. You play on the best team, there's a lot of good players and everybody's getting a good scholarship, right? And do you want your kid to go to school and sit on the bench, right? And I always tell the parents, look, I might sign mean at some points, but I call myself the ambassador of truth, right? I have to let people know this is basically how it works and this is where I see you. And they'll say, okay, well, what do you think I need to do, to up my stock? And I said, well, first of all, stop playing something other than little BS tournaments everywhere. Let's go to the British boys. You should be able to get into that. Let's play the English. Let's play, if they're younger, let's play the Italian U16. That's where you're playing against the elite of everybody in your age group in Europe. When you start getting to that level and you start performing well, now you've really stepped up to the big leagues.
I think one of the very important points you brought up is that you prepare them for the job interview, because if you got a kid sitting there, and the coach asks him, well, why do you want to go to Stanford? If you're not prepared for that kind of question, it could be an immediate you're not in, right?
But first of all, Stanford's kind of like the
I'm
Ausnahme.
just using it as an example.
I mean, but the coach knows what he's looking for and what type of player. If you come to Mannheim or at back in Sentinel when I was there, you recognize my kids if they're just on the putting green, okay? Because they got their stuff dialed in, they're working hard, there's no BSing going on. If you come to Mannheim, they're working hard, they're competing against each other and they're enjoying it, right? That's the number one thing. If I was coach, I don't care where I was coaching. I want guys that like to compete. They know that losing is not a condemnation, it's only a result. Okay. And you use that to get better. Okay. That's what you do. And the harder you push that guy, the better you're going to be, the better he's going to be. Those are the things you look for. And the top schools, that's where they're looking for. They're looking for people that want to compete. They want to compete every day, whether it's on the putting green, whether it's in qualifying to go to a tournament or at that tournament. They're not out there to say, oh, I finished a, you see some of these posts these kids have all the time. Oh, they show their score after the first round. And I'm talking about at every level of golf. And I think to myself, could you do anything stupider than that? Now you have the whole world watching you. And when you shoot 85, you're going to look like the biggest chump in the world. Okay. The preparation of the thing is You tell them about the coach. You tell them about the program. You say, this is the place. This is what they're looking for. And then I know, I said, you know, I had one kid who coach was really serious about signing. And I said to him, I said, look, I'm going to tell you something. He's losing his number two guy, and he wants you to come in at number two. I says, his scoring average for that two guy is about two lower than what you're doing right now. Are you ready for that? Oh, I know I can do it. I said, well, people don't usually get two shots better around overnight.
Right, exactly. So the number one on this little journey to a scholarship, the number one thing is you got to meet the academic requirements of the university, whatever they may be. Then you got the attention of the coach. Let's maybe talk a little bit about how good these kids really are. I found some general guidelines for a Division One golfer. I mean, you got to be able to drive the ball 270 plus, under 30 putts per round, and you got to have a scrambling percentage of 50%. Would that be accurate?
Oh, that's all bullshit. That's
Talk to
all
me.
bullshit. Let me tell you something, and I don't like to cuss when I know kids are
Yeah.
laughing, but people who know me know I'm not abstaining from four-letter words most of the time. But here's the deal, okay? First of all, there's people out there, organizations that publish, oh, if you average 81 or two, you can get a scholarship for this much in this level, 84 to 85 at this level. If you're averaging this, you can get D1, this. That's all complete, utter BS. Okay. I'm telling you right now, if you want to play in the big leagues, you got to play against the big boys at your age level right now and be able to compete very well. Putts, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of in my life. If a guy misses a lot of greens, but he doesn't miss them but on the fringe, he's got one putt because he's chipping in one putt. How does that equate to anything? What matters is this, okay? Who are you playing against and how difficult is the course? If you
Right.
could, British boys, which has the usually toughest golf courses and a lot of times bad weather, playing against the best players in the world, and you make the cut, that's a big check mark that you can play against the big boys because there's 200, well, now there's 144, but it used to be like 230 kids teeing off, right? So you've put yourself, you separated yourself from the masses. Now, if you lose in the second round of somebody who's really good and you lost one down, they're saying, hey, man, this guy's competing against the best guys in Europe. I looked at a kid's, sorry, I looked at a girl's portfolio on my website today because I did a tournament. I was like, man, this girl wins every time. And I looked down and she won like five times this year, but she's won every time by 12 shots because she's playing on these stupid tournaments, right? And her wagger must be off the charts, but it's kind of a paper lion, right? Because you haven't played against anybody, right? And that's the number one thing in the United States they want to know is who have you beaten? Because they have no idea by just looking at scores how good you are.
Right.
270 is the biggest bullshit in the world. I'll tell you right now. I
Yeah.
got that probably don't hit it more than 245 off the tee, and they'll beat you to death. Okay. Are they going to be able to play on 7,500 yards courses? Absolutely. If they're in the desert where the ball runs everywhere, if they're somewhere up in the north where it's cold and windy, probably not. Right. But most of the time, when you're up in the north where it's cold and windy, they don't have a lot of good golf teams. So if you can break 75, you might be a good player.
So
But
it's much more important where you play, who you play against, than how far
what?
you can hit it or to...
Where you mean what tournaments do you play
Exactly.
and be absolutely that's humongous. Now they still want to see that you can shoot under par scores. That's important. You look at my website on the profiles of a player, all scores that are under par in red. Because I want a coach to open up that kid's profile and say, bam, wow, look at all those red numbers.
Yeah. What are some of the top college golf programs in Division One today?
Well, I mean, Auburn won the national championship. The one of the best over year in, year out is Illinois, which is, you know, up north, but Mike Small's probably the best coach in the country. He's got a $20 million practice facility that if it was on booking.com, it'd be booked out, okay, just to go there and practice. I mean, Texas is unbelievable.
Yeah.
That Texas is always good. Arizona State's good. University of Florida is a top school that kind of go up and down. Texas Tech always has a good team. My Hurley's coach would kill me if I didn't say that. So there's a lot of good schools out there.
Eiberg came from Texas Tech too, right?
Yeah, Heber, exactly. He and Hurley were the first guys there. And I, top guys that ever got on tour from there. But that's where Tim is, Wiedemeyer. But
Yeah.
then let's talk about other things. Like for instance, Northwestern is one of the best business schools on the planet. If you're good enough to get in there, they have a great golf program. Okay, to me, this is the thing that parents need to deal with. Oh, well, they were ranked 60th last year. Well, guess what? 60th means you're going to regionals, okay? Which means you might go into the finals of the NCAAs. These are huge events where, with Wagger, with potential of turning pro, these are big checkpoints or check marks you can get next to your resume that shows you can compete against the best people in the world.
And the difference between Division One and Division Two, I mean, are you better off at a great Division Two school like Rollins or something like that, or a middle tier Division One school? Does that make a difference?
I'm going to tell you right now, here's what makes a difference. Can you play and can you get better? It doesn't matter where that is. The beauty of the thing, you can always transfer. There's a transfer porthole out there. You can transfer every semester. When I grew up and played, I went to school for a semester or a year at Maryland at Munich. And then when I came to the University of West Virginia, I had to sit out a year before I could play because I had transferred. Then they changed it where you could transfer once, then you had to sit out if you transferred again. Now you can transfer every semester. So all that matters is that you get in a place to develop. If you went to a golf, like how many people grow up at, let's take some random golf club that's a decent golf club and has a pretty good program, but they play in the third Bundesliga or something like that. And I don't know any names, but I mean,
It's enough. I mean, for
golf club. Alderwald, okay? And you're at Alderwald, and Seamus, the Irish pro, who's been there forever, has taught you how to play golf. You're a great chipper, and you don't lose balls, and you've done well in the AKAs in Baden-Württemberg or something like that. And then suddenly you get to the German championships of 14 and under, you finish third. Now suddenly the phone's ringing off the hook. All the big boys in the area want you to change to their club, right? Now you have to make the decision of, okay, what do I do? Well, I still want to take lessons from Seamus, but I want to go play with at Sankt-Leon-Roth, let's say, for instance, because that's a pretty big number in Germany. So you just sit down with them and say, hey, this is my setup. I'd like to train with this guy still, but I want to come play for the program. What do I have to do to play here? Okay. So the same thing happens in college. You could start off with junior college within a 2 years, right? And you got a division one and two. And that's a great platform for a young guy who played, and played for Seamus throughout his years. And maybe he didn't have the money to go play the British boys and everything, but he's a good player. So he can go there. He wins a couple of tournaments, and all of a sudden the division two and one school say, hey man, this guy looks pretty good. They call a coach, say, hey, what's the deal? We'd like to get him. Well, you can have him after this semester, right? Because they can then transfer into a bigger school. So all that matters is, look, there is no perfect formula. There is no guarantees that everything you do is right. You could go to a school and be an absolute superstar when you go there, but you don't like the coach, the guy you're rooming with is a dickhead, okay? You don't like the food, the weather sucks, and then you're like, you know what? I don't like it here. Or you could get lucky and go there and be an average player, but they got a lousy team. You start playing in the team. You don't have to qualify to get into the team. You really like the coach. And for the first time in your life, you feel special at a golf club. And that's the part that parents don't really understand when they're raising their kids to be golfers. Okay. Nothing's perfect. If things don't go well, teach your kid to be strong. Show them strength at a golf tournament. When you're watching them warm up and they're not hitting it well, look. They're not doing it on purpose. They're nervous, right? Just try to sell your kid. That's going to be okay. Relax. You're a good player. Instead of, hit another one left. That's another one left. That one went right. And I'm like, man, I'm telling you what, let's get the TrackMan out here and turn the sound on and get the spin numbers too. I mean, my God, relax with this kid. So now this kid's finally somewhere and he starts feeling comfortable there. So let's say he starts winning a couple of golf tournaments. Should he transfer to Division One? I'd stay there as long as I could if I thought I was getting better. Right? At some point, if you want to turn pro, it's not a bad idea to play in Division One against the best players. But if you look at the profiles of all the guys that play on tour, you would be surprised how many actually played NAIA, which is a smaller Dachverband, they call it in German. I don't even know what that is in English. What do they call that?
I have no idea. Fed something federation.
The Federation, yeah. That's the ones that determines the rules. There's two of them. two of them out there. Any rate, that I played at that level. And if you ask those guys, hey, what was your experience? I loved it. That was the best 4 years of my life. I became a really good golfer. Don't believe everything you tell them. You can become a good player in an AIA school. And for some people, that's the route to go. But if you're out there all with Porfirio, oh, little Johnny over there in my club, he's going to Division One school. Yeah, but it's in Iowa or it's in Wisconsin. No, I don't want to say Wisconsin. I've got a kid trying to go there. North Dakota State or something like, what do I know? Oh, you're in Division One. Yeah, 9 months of the year, you're going to be indoor hitting in the nets. Okay. And or you could be in Florida at one of the top D2 schools competing against D1 schools, having a time of your life.
Maybe you can give us some color on the format these kids play in college. How many kids on a team? How many kids actually go play? Match play, stroke play, that kind of stuff.
It's almost primarily it's stroke play, 3 rounds. And the way it works is you're only allowed to be away from school, I think it's 24 days a year, right? So they come, they play a practice round, they get up the next day, they play 36 holes in 1 day and 18 and go home. Okay. That way they don't miss any school. As little as possible. They don't count towards their stays. Now, if your school happens to go to Hawaii, that doesn't count against you. That's how they get schools to come out and compete against Hawaii. Because if anybody doesn't have a Google map, it's 6 hours from friggin' Los Angeles out to Hawaii. Trust me, I made that trip plenty of times. Okay. And nothing between you
Surprised you came back.
darts. No, but so that's how that works. Now, they do have match because in the past, the NCAA championships was all stroke play. There was no match play. But when they got tired of Oklahoma State winning all the time, right? They said, hey, let's make match play. So the way it works is you have regionals. Regionals, the top 70 schools get to regionals and also the ones that won their conferences. And then they have, like, I think five regionals. There might be 20 teams, and the top five teams move on to the finals. So now you're sitting there, let's make up a number with 25 teams, right? Only the top, I think it's eight, go into match play. Okay. From there, it's match play. So you better be good at match play if you want to win a national championship. So what happens now is like the Big 12 will have the Big 12 match play where they're there for 3 or 4 days and they play all against each other. It's almost like a World Cup in soccer where they're in groups of four. The winner plays the winner of that 9 yards to give the guys match play experience. But that's basically how it works. Now, at the lower levels, you might have an 18-hole event. D might have some 36-hole events, but all the big events are 54.
But if you go, if you're a German kid, and you get a scholarship to one of the schools, and you're a freshman, it doesn't mean that you're going to start on the team, that you're actually going to play, correct?
Frankie, there's two things that are connected, okay? Your level of scholarship, which usually means how good you are, and the responsibility of where you fit in the lineup, okay? When a coach is giving you a big scholarship, he's expecting you on day one to come in and step in and help carry that team. Which brings the next thing. Five players play and four scores count every day, okay?
And how many kids on the team?
There are five guys on a team. Next, starting in 2025, there's nine people on each, maximum nine on each team.
So four don't play.
That's right. Now, what can happen is, depending on the school, if they have the money, they can take you to a tournament as an individual. Sometimes they take two individuals. So there might be seven guys traveling. Two are playing as individual, the other five on a team. So what usually happens, not usually, it always happens, is all the individuals will play together. And it's not unusual for an individual to win a tournament or finish top five or something like that. But the coach isn't following him around because obviously he doesn't count towards the team. And he's playing with these other guys. So if he's tied for the lead for a guy who's playing for another team, he's never going to see that guy. That's how that works.
Even as a freshman, if you're good enough, you're playing, depending
Oh,
on.
absolutely. Hey, listen, you're playing, but I'm just trying to say there is a connection between the level of scholarship you got and the expectation of what you're going to do. And that's, something you got to deal with.
Well, I think there you have it. I mean, that's a pretty good damn insight into how college golf works. Let's talk about that brutal series of surviving and advancing the Q school.
Yes.
You just came back from the final stage with Mark Hammer, I believe. You were down there in Spain.
That is, yeah.
Is it as brutal as I imagine it?
No. They only listen, first of all, this is the thing that you have to teach people from the very beginning. You are playing a game. If you enjoy playing that game and you go there and you realize, you're sitting on the opportunity to win €1 million, okay? Because theoretically, that's what you can make if you play well every year on tour, right? And you don't have to play great, you just got to play well, okay? If you play poorly, you might only make $250,000. Now, I don't know what you do for a living, but I have to give a lot of golf lessons or put a lot of people in scholarships to make anything like that, right? So that's real money. So you can get excited about it or you can get nervous about it. I qualified maybe 5 times. I tried. I think 2 or 3 times I missed by a shot, right? And I always knew going into the thing, I said, I'm not going to worry till the last round, the last 9 holes, because that's usually where I screw up. So I was never under pressure because I knew I had till the last 9 holes where I usually screwed up. So I loved the idea of all of these top players coming down there. And they put themselves under so much pressure. Oh, I got to get on the big tour. I can't play the challenge tour again, all that kind of stuff. I thought that was great because, like, you know what? I don't really care where I play golf. I just like competing. That was always my attitude. And I had a hard time with Mark for years, but the guy has really, really come around. I mean, we've had long talks. We drive in a car together because if I go with him to caddy, we might drive 12 hours sometimes. You got a lot of time to talk in the car. Listen, of all the great players I've had, I put like 15 people on tour, on women's tours, men's tours and all that stuff. I mean, really good players. In the end, it's about helping this person deal with life. And golf is nothing more than like golf in a really intense, and life in a really intense atmosphere, okay? And if you give them the skills to deal with this, you're happy because whatever happens in life, they're ready to be successful or whatever it is they want to get done, whatever they need to do. So as far as like Mark's concerned, Mark's an extremely talented ball striker. I mean, he's the best iron player I've ever seen in my life, and I've been everywhere. The guy is absolutely incredible from about 5 iron down. Okay. He doesn't hit the ball as long as these guys. He's getting longer, and we're going to work over the winter. There's a couple of things we can change and tweak in a swing to pick up 3, 4, 5 miles an hour. And that's going to mean another flies another 15 meters. That's a big advantage, right? So here's what really matters. If you go down there and you're a lousy wind player, which I was my first time, and you're playing in this wind, I was like, you just have no clue how to deal with it, right? It takes you completely out of your comfort zone of how to deal with stuff. If you're a really good ball striker, the tougher the course is, the tougher the conditions, you have an advantage.
Absolutely.
Certain people, when you get them on a golf course that doesn't have that much trouble and they can carry it 280, 90 meters, man, they're going to be tough to beat, right? But if you go to a golf course and now you're qualifying, there's a lot of water left and right, man, those guys are usually out of it. Because they, even if they can hit their 2 irons down the middle, they're not feeling comfortable because they're not taking out their big stick, which is the thing that they rely on to score well with, okay? So is it tough? No. Is it very disappointing when you don't make it? Absolutely. Absolutely. But I always say, like I said to Mark, I said, Mark, we're playing 6 rounds at the qualifying school. Let's say there's 4 par 5s. That's 24 par fives. I said, the guys that hit it 20 yards further than you are up on the edge of the green or on the green, and we're chipping, pitching from 30 meters off the green. You're a phenomenal pitcher. But you're going to pitch it to 10 feet. They're going to chip it to 3 feet. I said, you can't beat that advantage. We have to get longer, right? That's in Mark's case. Maybe some other guys, they can only hit their driver, and you say, we got to learn to have another option off the tee. They might find that if they don't pitch well, or let's say they're playing in Bermuda and they are in Ireland the whole time when there's no Bermuda, they don't know how to deal with all the different shots that you get around the green out of Bermuda. So it just depends upon the situation. And then a lot of guys, sometimes they just get hot with the putter. The pressure decreases the closer you get to 20 under par because you've probably made it, right? You just keep cruising. The number one thing is get a plan for the golf course that allows you to take advantage of your skills or your, what do you call it, strengths, okay? And play away from your weaknesses. And there's nobody who goes out on every golf course and has strength for every hole. And once you get that plan down, then it's like Pac-Man. I watched a guy with Neil I worked with. He would do this Pac-Man. He sat there the whole damn lunch while I'm eating my sandwich playing Pac-Man and he never got caught. And I'm like, why didn't you go over there? You got more points. Oh, this is the pattern. And he sat there and did the pattern over and over and over and over and over. And then after a while, I said to myself, why the hell would you play a game if it comes out the same all the time, right? Well, golf's not that way, but you have to figure out a plan that if you make mistakes, you didn't penalize. Because let me tell you something, double bogeys, triple bogeys are absolute killer at a qualifying. You have to shoot on the average 3 to 4 under a round at the finals. And if you start off 3 over for 5 holes, you got some making up to do, brother.
How do you pre how did you prepare, Mark, for I mean, there's a lot of big names at the final stage. I mean, you're talking about Molinari, you're talking about guys that have won 4, 5, 6 times on the European tour.
How did I prepare him?
Yeah, I mean, playing against those guys.
Who cares about those guys? I mean, you're only playing. There's no. It's not like you walk into a room at a wedding and there's the table cards where everybody's sitting. Okay, I mean, these guys are all at qualifying school because they did something wrong. Okay,
Right.
off their card, off the big tour, they didn't get it off the challenge tour, or maybe they got exempt to the second stage or the final stage. I mean, they're not there to have fun, right? So most of those guys, something's missing, right? So you just kind of just got to know that you're playing at the beginning against, I don't know, whatever it's 180 guys, right? You can't really, if a guy goes out and shoots 11 under par, congratulations. You only need one spot, right?
Yep.
How did I prepare him? It's real simple. Throughout the year, you're always working to get better at certain parts of your game. That's what you do with Mark. The biggest challenge is getting Mark to understand what acceptance means. Okay. So here, I think probably when I explain this to Mark, and he's a great guy. He really is a great guy. Sometimes on the golf course, when things aren't going well, he's not fun to be around. Okay. But that's just part of the job, right? But when I told Mark, I said, Mark, you only have to do two things to get the most out of your game. His antenna went straight up. I said, he goes, what's that? I go, first of all, you have to understand that I don't care if you shoot 63, you are not going to play 18 holes hitting perfect golf shots. Okay. You might get up and down out of the worst line in the world for par. Okay. And that's how propelled you on to be able to shoot 63. And it might have been a double bogey and it turns out to be a 69, right? You will never, ever play a round of golf with all perfect shots. Okay. So you have to accept that's going to happen. Okay. The second thing you have to do is understand that you're going to have situations where you have to score better. If you hit it 10 feet, we got to make those 10 footers, or we've got to make a good portion of those 10 footers to shoot 66 or 65, right? And so then you look at his putting game. Say, okay, where is he weak? Where is he bad? If Mark loves right to left putts, I have stood there where if you put a friggin' marble on the ground, that thing rolled like crazy from left to right. And Mark says, what do you think, right edge? Like, right edge? I says, man, are you kidding? So you have to know what their weaknesses are. So if you're caddy in form, you kind of know how to steer them in a certain direction. We had a hole the last day, and there was mud on the left side of the ball. It was a par five, and we had to lay up because it goes around the corner. It's kind of a goofy hole, right? And he goes, the mud's on the left. It's going to go right. I go, yeah, that's right. He goes, where should I aim? I go, over there. He goes, why should I aim in the right center of the fairway? I go, it's simple, because that way, if you miss, it ends up in the right rough, which is not a bad shot to come into the green on. And he hits it and it goes into the green. And then we're walking down the fairway. He goes, why shouldn't I just aim left if I knew it was going right? I said, it's because the damn thing went straight. It went in the trees. I'd rather be in the right rough than in the trees. I said, there's always a certain amount of guessing that goes into what you're doing, right? And so what does he do? Gets up in the rough, pitches it to 6 feet, right? Out of the rough. And then I looked at him and said, there you go, P. I says, my two rules, and I told this to all players that I've taken to the tour school and caddy for, there's two things that you have to know to do well at the tour school. All birdie putts are good birdie putts, okay? And number two, you don't have to be 3 feet to make a birdie, okay? You take that into consideration, that affects how you deal with what's going on in the golf course and how you plan to deal with it. But that's to me, those are the things I work on. I think at that stage of a player's game, he's usually technically pretty good and efficient, right? And if he's having some issues, let's say a couple weeks out, then you want to know, hey, we got to get this fixed before we go down there. In our case, we were exempt into the second stage. He played really well in the second stage. and he got to he got he three putted the last hole, which he was all ready to give high fives when we're walking up the green. I'm like, hey mate, that putt goes downhill pretty bad there. I says, let's just focus on this putt. He hit the minute he hit it, I was like, oh man, like remember the old Dade Soogs in the Bonhof, ding 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 ding. I was going off my head. Went 4 feet by. He hit the most beautiful putt. The 360 horseshoe and came back out. He taps it in. We had to wait 2 hours. Then he won the playoff against four really good players, right?
Right.
But we played really well there. And then we went to the next stage, and we just didn't make enough putts. He hit the ball very nicely, but he didn't make enough putts.
So he was exempt the first stage, and then for the second stage, do you get to pick the venue? I mean,
It's
you
all
choose where you play?
drawn. Oh no, it's all drawn. You
No.
can choose at first stage, second stage, it's drawn.
They tell you. Okay. All right. If you were in first stage, how would you choose a venue for your player?
Well, so it fits your game. I mean, absolutely. And then, you might be playing on the Challenge Tour because you're so bad, but you have to decide then between, am I going to play an event that week, to try to get up the rankings, or do I like this? In the old days up in Flesensee. What's in that course that's up there? They got about five courses on it. Is it called
No
Flesensee? I think in it.
idea.
But they played a course there that was absolutely, if you were good off the tee right to left, you could just annihilate that golf course.
Right.
And I would go up there with guys that had that style of game. They shoot 20 under every time, and then you get through, right? So you just have to know the different courses, and you kind of get your kid on a course. I told this to Hurley the first time he went to tour school. There was a tight school, it was in Austria. There was a very tight hole. You get 4 iron and a sand wedge. And he's, I'm hitting driver. I said, Hurley, you don't need to hit driver. I can drive the green. I like to hit my driver. I said, Hurley, I said, just hit a 4 iron and a sand wedge. You play the hole 2-1 or 2 under. That's all you'll need for this week. No, I'm hitting driver, right? So long story short, that didn't work out too well for him, right? And in the end, he missed by one shot. And I'm going to tell you something. Under pressure, the last six holes, Tiger Woods couldn't have played better. I mean, the shots he was hitting, the putts he was making
Right.
was in the zone. You're just watching this, you go, God, this is phenomenal, right? And then we drive home the whole way to Austria. And I said, son, the first stage is a filtering out process. If you finish first or 18th or whatever place you got to finish to get to, that's all that matters. I said, if you go there as one of the best players in the tournament, you don't need to give away six or eight shots trying to play, too aggressively. You probably hate me for telling that story, but he learned his lesson right there. And obviously, because he did really well on the Challenge Tour the next year, he finished seventh in COVID, but they only took five. Normally they won. And the year after that, he made his tour card. And then after that, he had a phenomenal year. And then last year, he played solid, had one real good finish. And this year wasn't a good year for him. But the one thing I always say for my son is when you talk to him, he explains things out of his perspective as to what happened. And then you say to yourself, my God, I'm glad that went sideways if he learned that. It's like, it's so impressive to listen to him talk about how he digests the situation. He never drives himself nuts. It's really, really impressive, which, I have a little bit different history.
there's also a bunch of amateurs playing at the final stage, right?
Absolutely. You can play now in professional golf. And I think this has finally gotten to the level where it needs to be. Amateurs can compete against professionals and win up to $1,000 in an event, okay? Cash. Their hotel room costs just as much as pros, right? So who's being punished by that? Probably the parents or whomever's paying for it, right?
Right. What does it cost to play Q School?
I think it's like 3,000 or 3,500 pounds.
That's 3 grand, yeah. And you got college scouts or agents walking around the range and.
Walk around, no college scouts, because I mean, if you're turning pro, they got no business with college. It's going to college, but there's agents at the finals. Sure, absolutely, walking around. And if an agent likes a player and he goes to the second stage and he hasn't signed him, he might show up there too just to walk around. So the guy gets comfortable seeing him. Absolutely.
Right. So for Mark, it was a process, and even though he missed the last two rounds, it was a good experience for him.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think so. I think, I always say as a coach, I want to see how people bounce back, right? In the past, he might have spent 3 weeks with a cup going, Buck, I'm not really interested. But I'm telling you something. We drove back in the car to the airport and then on the plane, and then we drove from there to his place. And I said, Mark, I want to get a 3D analysis with you. And the national fitness coach can do them, right? Where they hook you up to all this stuff to try to find the angles and energy and all that stuff. I said, there's two things I want to know. I'm going to tell you something. 2 days later, he drives up to St. Leon Road and does one, right? And then 2 days later, we were practicing. And he just like, and now he called me today and he's like, man, I'm sitting here for 2 days now. Man, I can't wait to get back out on the golf course. And I'm like, man, what a great attitude. He's really, he's enjoying it so much that he's ready to compete. And that's really where you want to be. If you're out there for the money, it ain't going to take long till you
Exactly.
figure out that, that ain't working out the way you wanted it to.
Well, Adi developed this 3D system, this Elva Golf. I don't know if you've heard about it, without hooking you up to all these things. You talk to him about that. But speaking of not making it through school, Q school, the legendary Mac O'Grady tried 17 times before he made it on the tour.
Phil O'Glenn and Mick Leonard, whatever his
Yeah,
name was.
exactly. Scratched from both sides, from
Listen,
lefty.
hey, here's the deal, okay? I mean, I'm the poster child for all this, okay? I was a hell of an amateur. I won like 39 tournaments in 3 years and I was beholfstady. I was working. And then I just said, man, I got to, and Richard Taylor's a pro at Greifswald. He was my good buddy. He said, Teddy, you got to go out there and try to play. And I had another friend of mine say, oh, Teddy, you got to compete. You got to play. And I was making a lot of money in the computer business. I mean, I was a command and control information specialist at a top security clearance. Life was good, baby. You know what I mean?
The golden days.
I quit 6 months later. I was picking up the range balls at Hadleberg Golf Club where the militaries were giving golf lessons for $15 a half hour. Okay. So that's the way it goes. But what I was getting at is they didn't have a third tour back then. They didn't even have a second tour. It
Right.
was the road to Mecca. You went down there once a year. You had once a year, had one chance. The good news now is, heck, if you play halfway decent on a third tour, you can make 25, 30,000, throw in some sponsors and stuff. You're living at your parents' house. You're not really struggling. And then you get onto the challenge tour. There's more money out there. I mean, it's not killer money, but the top 20 guys are making good money.
Right.
The guys winning the thing are making two, three, over pushing 300,000 euros. All of this was non-existent when I played, right? So these guys have a chance to still pursue their goals, make good money, and enjoy life.
Yeah, one of the things I didn't mention when we talked about colleges is that the PGA Tour now has this thing called PGA University.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I think the origin of that was that the college coaches, with their lobby, and listen, let's face it's a small world out there, right?
Right.
They said, hey, look, man, we're losing these. We're doing everything we can to get a guy here. He plays here a year and a half, and then suddenly in the middle of the year, he turns pro, right? And what a lot of these young kids don't know, and certainly their parents don't know, is that's a tough road out there. When Hurley turned pro, he decided to play the Pro Golf Tour. The pals, especially like Jeremy, he always liked playing in the States. They played the Canadian Tour. And
Right.
Hurley said to me, that is the hardest tour in the world because you got to finish top five to get on the what's now called the Korn Ferry Tour. He says there's 50 All-Americans that graduate every year that play that tour. He says, and you got to finish top five, right? You got to play your ass off. You finish seventh, you're back on that same tour next year, right? And it took Jeremy and Yannick a while, to get through that to the Korn Ferry. And Yannick then came back here and got a gone on a good run on the challenge tour and then end up getting his card, right? And Jarrah just, I don't know how many years it's been that he got onto the Korn Ferry Tour, let's say 4 or 5 years. He played that for a while and this year won the first event. Now he's on the PGA Tour,
Right.
right? So the idea is that the players, if you finish in the top 10, I think the top five get maybe PGA Tour cards. The other guys get Korn Ferry Tour cards. You might get different levels of status. And let me tell you something right now. There's guys out there that carry a rule book and can tell you what's on page 57. Okay. You need one of those guys to figure out all the different categories on these tours.
Right.
The category, they might have 16 categories on the challenge tour, right? Former winner of this, and the European tour is even worse. They got categories out there. If you are the official speaker for the the Players Association on the European Tour, you basically play every event, even
Yeah,
though.
I'm. You know, Freddie Schott, who missed the, who didn't make it through the first four rounds at the final stage, is in the field the next week at the European Tour event opening.
Then, because he just barely missed his card
Right.
through the rankings, I think he finished 117th, and I think 115 got in or something like that. So what happens is, all the good players, you think Rory McIlroy is going to go down and play in Australia somewhere for $1.5 million of thing? It costs you $1.5 million to get him to show up, right? So a lot of those guys have come off a long season. They just kept their card, and they're like, "Man, I'm taking 4 or 5 weeks off, recharge
Right.
battery." Because once the season starts, it's a long season. When I played, at the end of whatever it was, September, it was over, and it didn't start again until March. So those early events, if you're willing to go down there, you're going to get into them, and that's
Right.
what happened to him. And then obviously, who knows, you might win one. Freddie's a very good player, and I'm going to tell you something. I've known him. He played with Max Oefke in the first round at Vlissingen, and I was caddying for Max. And he was walking around with his mother, who's a very nice lady. He hit the ball straight up in the air. He could see he was a strong ball striker. And I was
Yeah.
like, this kid's a nice kid, but man, he got a lot of long way to go. But he's had a lot of good people around him. I know he's a very good friend of Marcel Siem's. And man, he's really
Yeah.
developed.
And he's still young as well. I mean,
He's going to be around for a long time. I think he'll be a very, very
yep.
solid player in the
Yep.
next couple of years. And when you see him now, and I saw him then, I'm like, wow, this guy's very impressive.
Yeah.
And he's phenomenal, phenomenal English. I've only ever spoke German with him, right? And then I heard him talking to an official, and I was like, damn, Freddie, I'll never speak in German with you again. That's embarrassing how good.
Yeah, but as a coach, at TED, you never really know when that breaking point's going to come. I mean, Aberg is the perfect example. I mean, he went from a college player to, a guy who played on the Ryder Cup team in his first year on tour. I mean, did anybody?
Ray Charles one there. He was a Ray Charles one. You took a guy 6'4" with an absolute gorgeous golf swing, whose ball speed's 185, and he's beating people like a redheaded stepchild at the college level. He's playing against the best amateurs. And if you meet this guy, he's the most wonderful person in the world. Nothing seems to get to him. And then when he turned pro and played in Europe, listen, he's a top 20 player in Europe coming out of college, okay? So hard for him to compete. And he just did that perfectly, just went right up the thing. And then he also profited from, because all this live stuff, those guys couldn't play in the Ryder Cup, so they took him. Man, that was, you talk about a guy who jumped from one trampoline to the next trampoline
Yeah.
and managed to hook a ride with a Saturn V rocket to the moon. Wham! I
Yep,
mean,
yep, yep.
every checkpoint perfectly. But if you've ever seen the guy swing at plate, you're like, man, this guy is a big money honey.
Yeah.
Halbert, what's Nikolai on Rasmus?
Yeah, Højgaard.
Oh, my God. I've known them since they were 16.
Yeah.
Phenomenal attitudes these guys had, and they killed the ball, okay? So you just knew they competed and won since they were 16. Look at my rankings. Remember what I told you, okay? 14, 16, 18, college, all those guys are superstars. It's okay. Are they going to be superstars on the PGA Tour? No. But if they get on the tour and stay there for 3 to 5 years, man, these guys are successful. And these days in the States, if you get on the tour, you can play 5 years, you're set for life if you manage your money right. Okay. So it's not hard to see that. But there's special guys out there when you see them and go, man, this guy's unbelievable. Hurley called me the first time he played with John Rahm, and he says, Daddy, he says, I just played with a guy who's top 10 in the world disguised as an amateur. He says, this guy is so good, it's unbelievable. John Rahm was always, for Hurley, the measuring stick for how good you had to be at certain things to be successful, right? And I think that was one of the things that always propelled him into becoming a successful golfer. But 6 months later, he had turned pro and he was top 10 in the world. So there's guys out there, it's not a surprise. They drink. They don't go carousing. You don't have to get them out of bed in the morning. They do everything. I tell you what, I always knew that Yannick Paul was going to be a very successful player. He had a great attitude towards everything. He was very friendly, hardworking. He was phenomenal under pressure. And once he got a little bit bigger and he worked out regularly, he just kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger. So it was never a surprise to me that he was going to be successful.
Hard work beats talent every day of the week, I
I
think.
realize that, but I'm going to tell you something like this, okay? The world needs Dick Stickers too, as you know. There are people out there who are.
Okay, Judge Smales.
I get more balls than anybody, okay?
You go.
Like these people say differential learning. Oh, you do this and the brain tell you, listen, man, I did everything, okay? And I'm not stupid and I didn't figure some things out quite right.
There you go. Let's close this podcast with it's again, it's end of November. What's in store for Ted Long in 2025? What are your goals, your plans? Tell us a secret.
Well, first of all, my life is broken up between my players or whoever team I'm working with, and then my website, and I've a degree in computer science. I've done a lot of development of systems and applications programming. So I'm bringing out the next level of my website, which I think is going to be huge. And then that's going to obviously crank up the old monetary side because coaches are going to start having to pay for all this analytics that I've got on the players. So, and that's my number one priority over the winter. I mean, Hurley actually called me the other day for the first time in like 9 months and asked for help. He wanted to do everything on his own. And I'm proud of him that he wants to do that. Obviously, the father, you also want him to be successful. So, and then Mark Hummer, I got him and I've got a bunch of other players. Some of my players are moving from Mannheim to another club. So I'm getting all that set up and I'm just trying to get that chapter in their life organized. I'm doing scholarships. When I go to the States, I always probably take at least 5 or 6 trips where I stop off, watch a golf tournament, meet some court, some club, some coaches, visit their university if they're on the way. Just because I want, when I tell the parents and the players what a place like, I like telling that out of firsthand
Yeah.
experience.
Yeah, I
And
mean,
I'm
if you send somebody to Texas Tech, if you send a German kid to Lubbock, Texas, okay, in a I don't know how big Lubbock is, but the school's got 40,000 kids. The football games and the that's the social fabric of the school. They got to be people that can deal with that or they're not.
Right. But and you will know this, and this is a really good example. If you're from the Hamburger Golf Club, okay, or let's say the Frankfurter Golf Club or the Münchner Golf Club, probably more Hamburg than anybody else, okay, you're growing up in a really elite atmosphere with smart people, successful people, really well raised, well spoken, and all the people from Hamburg are like that, right? Okay. And you go out to friggin' Lubbock, Texas, okay, where there might be a shotgun in all the friggin'
Yeah, gun
bars.
rack and the pickup trucks.
Out there going from a beautiful city, from a beautiful golf club to the desert. Okay. Now I'm not talking tumbleweed, but I'm talking close to tumbleweed where there's nothing. Okay. It's this massive city and the golf course is out. It's a nice golf course, but it doesn't have any trees on it. It's windy as hell. The one good news is it's a big cattle place, so you get cheap steaks. Wide open spaces, a lot of right-wing Republicans, you might have a problem, okay? But if you take somebody who's from some school in Bayern or something like that, and he's out there and, I don't know where the pampas is. I mean, I'm not saying that Gunther Valaya, but you start heading down there somewhere, those people are like relaxed people with open spaces. Like Tim Vidmeyer, he probably loves it in Lubbock because it's like a turbo version of wherever he's from in Bayern. It just depends on who it is and where they're going. But listen, I always tell people this: the world is an amazing place. And I know you, Frankie, you've been everywhere, right? What a pleasure it is to see something new. I mean, let me tell you something. My mom makes the greatest lasagna in the world, but I couldn't eat it 7 days or 15 days in a row, right? So, it's nice to be able to learn and see something. And remember this, you're only going there for a year. 4 years, a semester, whatever, and you go someplace else. Make the most of every opportunity you have to learn something different and have a nice experience. If all you're missing is mom's lasagna in your room, you're probably not going to have a very exciting life.
Yeah, what a closing statement that is. And one other goal for you might be to actually win a Roto Fest next year.
Frank, I'm going to tell you something right now.
That.
I really think you're probably the only one that knows this. Because those other guys don't know me. I go in there and try to act like the biggest idiot. I'm only patient Asians because Asians are the best players. I'm only going to pick guys with slow backswings because it's a tight course. I always come in with some angle, and it's hilarious to see
It's
some
hilarious.
guys bite on all that stuff, right? To me, who cares about it? It's the stupidest game ever, you know. I hate that system, but just to be in there amongst all those guys from all over the world, right? It's phenomenal.
Yeah,
Phenomenal.
we got a new guy from Spain, Roderick Bastard, the guy that qualified for the Senior Open. He's going to join us. You'll like him.
Oh, I'm going to tell you something right now. Guys for a freaking cold. I mean, they're going to come in there and they've probably done their homework and all the analytics, right? And then I start popping off the mouth. Worst teams ever picked. I mean, remember Heinze, baby? Yeah. Oh, he talked like this, and yes, he's a good player, and you know, everything was very slow. And I'm going to go with Lee Trevino. I said, what? Where is this in a seniors event? He's gonna play well. He's always played well on links course. I say he's got an oxygen machine. What are you picking him for? You know what I mean? All that stuff. Some guy's gonna come in, and the first thing we do is let him know where he's at.
That's what it's all about, and
Exactly.
we all do miss Heinz. Ted,
Exactly.
listen, thank you so much for today. I mean, I think this is the first of its kind that we've heard so much about college golf for a German audience, and even though it was in English, but I really don't give a shit.
Wurde
listen, I wish you all the best as always. It's always good to see you. And another year goes by without me making it down there to take a lesson from you. But
I'm happy to hear that.
I'm just going to let my game sink even lower so you can do a better job.
I'm gonna tell you something right now. In your life, when I played with Richard Taylor, we had a guy named Phil. He was a tennis instructor at Bad Homburg. He was from Australia. He was a great guy, a great guy. And we always played and we had wooden clubs, and that's where I got my name Longball. I didn't give it to myself. They called me that, right? Phil said one time when he was at Richard's house and they were having a drink, and Richard's wife, who was from Leeds, she was very direct, right? He was on, I'm gonna practice, I'm gonna work out all winter long, and you'll see. And at some point I'm gonna outdrive Ted Long. And his wife said, Phil, as long as you have a hole in your ass, you will never outdrive Ted Long. Why do I say that? Every time we're together, I look at your hair and I remember all the great hair I used to have. That's something you got on me for life. I love your hair. And I like the way you have the light that you have. It's yellow light, so it looks like it's blonde.
Exactly. Exactly. My friend, have a good rest of the weekend. We will talk soon.
And I wish all of your viewers a wonderful Advent season,
Well,
health,
there you go.
and I hope all your kids get straight A's. And I'll get their handicaps down to +5, and I'll see you on the golf course.
They're working on it.
I love
To
you.
the Links land, ladies and gentlemen.